Tarot Show with your host, Lonnie Clark. We stand together and accept that we now live in a world transformed by Fukushima. Monday, Wednesday, and Friday from 8 a.m. to 9 a.m. Pacific Standard Time here on UCY.TV Radio. We relentlessly engage every ear that listens. We expose and confront the complete lack of accountability for the nuclear industry. Consider social engineering programs who view our bodies, minds, and souls as assets on a balance sheet. We discuss vital current issues, interview activists, and engage our audience in an effort to allow all voices to be heard. The Age of Vision radio show creates a venue that all will choose. We encourage our listeners to reclaim their power and their courage to take action and save our planet from the ravages of greed and indifference. Our actions matter. Every voice matters. We remind our listeners that happiness is resistance. Love is greater than fear.
Good morning, UCY.TV radio listeners. This is Lonnie Clark with the Age of Vision radio show. Thank you for joining us. Today is May 26, 2017. It's 8 o'clock in the morning here on the West Coast. I'm going to dig right in because our guest today is Mr. Chuck Johnson, a friend of our show from Oregon Physicians for Social Responsibility. We have quite a bit to talk about. Thanks, Chuck, for joining us today. It's great to have you back.
Yeah, it's great to be on. Thanks.
Well, look, I want to dig right into what happened here in Oregon. We had a small victory here in Oregon. The NuScale, the developing company, the nuclear company that came out of Oregon State University that is developing these new SMRs, they call them SMRs, small nuclear reactors, they had put together a bill and somehow got it passed through the Senate. And through your efforts and a bunch of other activists, the room was packed and the bill was stopped. But how is it? Let me ask you this question. How did they even get to the Senate? Because I know you constantly watch the calendar there. How did they get that through there?
Well, because we weren't constantly watching the calendar. It really was a mistake on the part of me and others who ordinarily would be looking for something like this. And the way it works in the Oregon legislature is that there's a deadline for submitting bills, and after that deadline had passed, I stopped looking, and a friend of mine who normally would look at this also stopped. But unfortunately, each legislator has two priority bills that they can introduce after the deadline. So really, you should never stop looking.
That's the lesson of 2017, I
that's
guess.
That's exactly right. And I knew that lesson. I've worked in the Oregon legislature. So the action in the Northwest on small modular reactors in terms of state legislatures has all been in Washington state. So we've spent a bunch of time in Olympia fighting efforts to try to make it legal to build small modular reactors in Washington. The boosters in the Tri-Cities area, which is the community around the Hanford Nuclear Reservation, have wanted to be the first site for building this NuScale small modular reactor system. And there's a state law in Washington that says that any reactor or any energy facility over 350 megawatts needs to be referred to the voters before bonds can be sold to finance it. And this is because they had a bad experience of building five nuclear power plants during the 70s and 80s, the Washington Public Power Supply System, defaulting on bonds for two of them. And and then the two others were not completed, and we're still paying for those through our rates at through the Bonneville Power Administration, plus the one that was completed and still operating, the Columbia Generating Station. So due to that experience in 1981 in Washington, they said that the voters statewide would have to approve bond sales for large power producing plants. And despite the name small modular reactors, the way that this NuScale design works is it's 50 megawatt reactors, but in a pack of 12. So altogether, a 600 megawatt reactor system. And we had been arguing all along that you couldn't say that these were 50 megawatt reactors, that you had to, if you were going to build a system in Washington, you would have to count it as a 600 megawatt facility. Apparently, the other side agreed with us because they tried to pass an exemption to that, but we stopped it in the Washington House a couple of years ago, and we've been successful in blocking other efforts to encourage building a small modular reactor factory in Washington and some other things they've been doing up there. So we didn't really think that anything was going to happen in Oregon this year. They had an informational hearing about 2 years ago, which the chair at the time of the House Environment and Energy Committee in Oregon said was just a courtesy hearing for one of the members of the committee. But we brought people out to speak against it and had a very contentious hearing, actually.
Wasn't that the hearing where they turned the lights out on the people? They didn't give them enough time and said, enough, we're done, it's time,
well,
to click.
This hearing,
they actually let everybody speak. This chairman allowed every single person to go a little bit over and allowed every person to talk.
This was a much better process. The way that was done was they gave Oregon State University and NuScale almost a full hour to present the wonders of the small modular reactor at the hearing 2 years ago. And then the chair basically let them talk about twice as long as what she had originally intended, and then tried to hustle the anti-nuclear people off. And there were only five of us there, you know, so should have given us at least a decent amount of time. I actually had to assert my right to just finish my testimony, which wasn't very long. And then one of the people who had come to testify had at the last minute decided she needed to go to the bathroom. And so she came rushing back after the chair had closed the hearing on the bill and was insisting on talking. And the chair wouldn't reopen it for her to talk. But she went up there and began speaking anyway. So the chair just cut off her mic, and she and the vice chair just walked away from the hearing, leaving. It was the most ragtag hearing I've ever seen, and I've spent four sessions in the legislature.
This one was very well. I mean, the room was packed. I mean, let's review exactly what this Bill 990 did. This was egregious. Why don't you review what this bill did?
Basically, it creates an exemption in Oregon state law. In 1980, the Oregon voters passed an initiative that requires that before any new nuclear plants can be built in the state of Oregon, that there is a federal high-level radioactive waste repository established, and that there's an agreement to accept the waste from that nuclear plant. And then it would still be referred to a statewide vote of the people of Oregon. This bill creates an exemption for reactors smaller than 300 megawatts, and it says it doesn't have to meet any of the waste requirement, and that the public vote would only have to be at a city or county level where a local community had agreed that it made sense to build a nuclear power plant. So obviously just completely derailed our state protections against new nuclear plants. Unfortunately, this bill did not get contested in the Senate because it came up late And because it came through a hearing that most of the environmentalists don't follow, the Business and Transportation Committee, not the Environment Committee. But it turns out that committee actually is the one that normally would hear, that it was hearing a lot of energy bills. So it was not really an abnormal assignment. But for whatever reason, the only person who actually noticed that this bill was happening was a Portland attorney named Dan Meek, the only opponent. And he came and testified, but inexplicably, he didn't contact any of the rest of us to tell us that this bill was happening. So I first learned about it from a friend of mine who lives in Washington, D.C. He's on the staff, and he's a staff scientist for the Union of Concerned Scientists, Ed Lyman.
That's interesting. Washington,
D.C. Yeah, he sent me an email saying, hey, this bill looks really bad, don't you think? And I looked at it, and I went, yeah, and it's already passed the Senate.
Pretty much bad, yeah.
It came out of the committee five to nothing, and
I was stunned when it passed. I called Floyd Przanski, who's my representative, and I'm like, my senator. I was very angry. I expressed my dismay. I could not believe he agreed to it.
Well, apparently, what he has told people is that he believes it's safe, and that we need to prove to him that it's not safe. I think what needs to be pointed out to Senator Przanski and others who have been listening to NuScale is that this reactor hasn't been built yet, so I don't know how anyone could prove that it's safe. It hasn't been approved by the Nuclear Regulatory Commission. So the only, you know, assurances of its safety and its viability are coming from the company itself at this point. So,
it is a little premature,
But because nobody was presenting the other side in the Senate, there were four people who voted no, and a couple of them spoke on the floor, but they didn't have time to prepare. They didn't even know it was coming up until that morning when they looked at what bills were coming onto the floor. So Lou Frederick from Portland and Michael Dembro from Portland voted no, and Lori Monas Anderson from Gresham and Senator Manning, the new senator from Eugene, voted no. Everyone except one other senator who was absent voted yes, including a lot of liberals and progressives and people who consider themselves progressives anyway, and people who are 100% environmental voters voted yes on this. We do have a debt of gratitude. I would not have heard about this from Ed Lyman had not the Oregon League of Conservation Voters put out an alert to its membership, which we're not a member. I would have found out if we had been. Saying, this bill looks bad. Does anybody think we should do something about this in the House? I mean, and Union of Concerned Scientists sent the message on to their higher ups, and it found its way to Ed Lyman and then to me and then to Lloyd Marbet and everyone else, and at that point the floodgates opened and we organized a lot of people. We did have help from OLCV and from Oregon Sierra Club and the Union of Concerned Scientists, and also Columbia Riverkeeper has been busy with a lot of other issues, but Dan Sears took enough time to go and do some personal lobbying on this and submitted testimony. And I saw that Citizens Utility Board submitted testimony in opposition as well. They didn't participate in the lobbying effort, but they came out against it. So it wasn't just on the anti-nuclear people to go out and organize on this. It was also kind of a broad spectrum of environmental groups thought this was a bad policy. Certainly premature in the case of something like NuScale, because they don't have a reactor. They're not prepared. There isn't any utility in Oregon that is ready to finance a non-existent reactor. Their timeline is such that they won't even know if their license is approved by the Nuclear Regulatory Commission for their design until spring of 2020.
So they're laying down the groundwork. They're laying down the brainwashing on the elected officials is what they're doing.
Well,
because
this is,
really,
yeah.
Their testimony was like, the world is doing this. If you guys don't do it, you're going to be left behind. And this is clean. This is safe. We're burying the waste. So there's no transport and it's all perfectly safe. And I'm thinking to myself, wasn't there an article? Well, you guys did an article about the earthquake faults we're sitting on, but there was an article in, I think, National Geographic or some science kind of magazine that I read about 2 years ago that explained that Oregon is sitting on top of geologically unstable. They discovered a magma chamber underneath from Yellowstone that comes all the way over to Oregon. So, you know, it's a really, I mean, really honestly, like, but this was obviously then, if that's the case, this was just them going through the exercise of getting this bill, of getting our legislators used to having this bill introduced to them. And by the time they are ready for it, they can go, oh, yeah, those SMRs, they're pretty good. Let's just pass that along. They're not that bad.
I think that's true. I think they were surprised that we didn't resist sooner. This bill, they claim that this bill was not something they initiated, and that I think that might be true because it's written a little bit strangely.
Well, what do you mean
Senator
by that?
Boquist, written, Senator Boquist was inspired by them, certainly, because the reason he introduced it was, you know, having done a tour in Corvallis of their facility and everything else. And he introduced it. I spoke with him and his wife, Peggy, who's his, one of his staffers. They were thinking that this might be useful as something as resilience to the grid if we did have a major earthquake, which, you know, is, to my way of thinking, is really backward thinking to think that a nuclear plant would be something you'd rely on in a power outage. It's kind
exactly.
of the opposite of the truth, but I think they were, I mean, they're very sincere people. I don't, you know, we had actually very honest conversations with them, and I think they learned some things in our conversation with them. Senator Boquist was actually not even there to present his bill. The hearing was held, again, as a courtesy in this case, because the decision had already been made a week ago, at which for the deadline that the legislature imposes on itself, that they weren't going to have a work session. So once they decided not to have a work session by the end of Friday of last week, the bill could not leave committee. So this hearing, again, ended up being a symbolic hearing in the House. Certainly wasn't symbolic in the Senate. It passed the Senate. But in the House, it was, by the time we had our hearing, they had just decided that they weren't going to let the bill get any further. But we needed to be there, as you say, to make an impression, because this will certainly not be the last time they're going to try to do something like that.
No, and hopefully next time we'll have a big turnout if they even dare to put it through the Senate, which we know they will. They have nothing to lose. So they're
right.
just going to, and especially if you're saying that they know they can't even start till 2020, you said, you know,
well,
this is just.
Later
is,
than that. It's later than that. I mean, they'll have their license by from the NRC by 2020 if it all goes well. But the first reactor that they're scheduled to build is in Idaho, and they're not anticipating having it done until 2026. Mm-hmm. So they actually have utilities they're negotiating with in Utah and Idaho, small municipal utilities, to buy the power. I suppose if that fell through, they might see if they could find somebody in Oregon who'd be willing to build a plant like that. I don't know. But the earliest of that you would expect to have a plant finished would be 2026. And construction would be starting in 2022, according to their current schedule. So they need to have a change in Oregon's law by probably a couple of years before breaking ground. So by 2020, 2021, they would need a change in Oregon law if they were going to build the first one in Oregon. I just don't think they'll do that. There's so much less resistance in a state like Idaho at this point. And the community that they're planning on building it in is right next to a one of the nuclear labs that was part of the U.S. Defense Complex, the Idaho National Laboratory, out near Idaho Falls, where a number of experimental reactors were run during the Cold War in developing the nuclear navy. So it's a community sort of like Hanford that really wants the chance to develop a new nuclear technology. And that's it for your listeners. This is what's really interesting is that, you know, Oregon has historically been resistant to nuclear, has fought off, passed this law that fought off two additional plants, shut down the Trojan plant early, due to, in large part, to the very dogged efforts of Lloyd Marbette and his friends, who were putting up ballot measures every chance they could to have it shut down.
And Lloyd Marbette is the executive director of the Oregon Conservancy Foundation.
Right. And he spoke. He was on our first panel as well. He was there speaking in opposition and got a lot of people to come and to make comments if they weren't able to attend. But, here in Oregon, at Oregon State University, is the final design or the latest design that the nuclear power industry is hoping will be the next great thing in nuclear power development, now that Westinghouse is flaming out in Georgia and South Carolina, and all the other SMR prototypes are being abandoned or at least put on hold by their developers. This one is the only live proposal at this point that the NRC is considering for a new reactor design. We're kind of at nuclear power, new nuclear central for the United States right now here in Oregon.
Huh, that's really interesting to think about. Yeah. You know, mm-hmm. I've been reading a lot about the nuclear industry is not making a resurgence, and I in large part because their facilities are falling apart. The gig is up. People are seeing that the industry is so completely negligent. They're grotesquely negligent and the disregard for human life. So I think that if we continue to put the pressure on, me personally, I'm hoping that within 10 years, the whole conversation about building nuclear power plants will be completely dead. As like I said in my testimony, we need a shift from the nuclear industry. We don't need to build new power facilities. We need them to figure out what to do with the waste that we're drowning in. I mean, I was really glad that Mark Rabinowitz brought up the abandoned uranium mine in Lakeview. It just sits there. You know how they remediate it? You know what their solution is? They pour salt on it every 10 years around the perimeter. Seriously, that's their solution. They haven't even figured out, they have neglected the science of remediation and figuring out how to manage this. The disregard.
Well, as Mark said, you know, if the engineering school at Oregon State University wants to continue to operate, there's a very noble function they could be serving right now, which would be to really begin studying how to remediate all of these nuclear waste sites, including the uranium mines. And there's going to be a need, unfortunately, due to all of the busyness of the nuclear industry over the last 70 years. You know, we've got generations upon generations of nuclear jobs ahead, mm-hmm. and they don't involve generating more of this stuff. They involve dealing with what we've already created.
It's true. Yeah. It's actually really true. So, Chuck, what is the new focus now that Oregon Physicians for Social Responsibility has worked effectively with the community to stop this bill dead in its tracks? What is your next focus? Where are you guys looking to?
Well, we're still not quite done with this. We are going to spend time going back to the senators because we're not going to just accept the idea that 25 out of the 30 senators support nuclear energy. I think that we can get that number down to hopefully a majority opposing it. So we're going to be spending some time between now and the end of the session trying to individually talk to these senators and encourage people to talk to their own senators, just as you've done with Senator Pozanski, to explain to them why this is really a terrible idea. So that's one thing. And the other thing that we're doing is we are starting to branch out a bit more in our efforts to close the Columbia Generating Station nuclear plant, which is the one last operating nuclear power plant in the Northwest on the Hanford Nuclear Reservation, a Fukushima-like reactor in that it's a GE boiling water reactor of similar vintage with some of the same vulnerabilities. And one of the things that last night I attended a meeting in Eugene of Eugene Wand, Women's Action for New Directions. And they had two speakers, one a poet, Kathleen Flinnikin from Seattle, who is a Hanford, grew up in Hanford and worked at Hanford briefly and has written some wonderful poetry. Her book of poems, Plume, is much of it is about Hanford and about the dealing with living in this nuclear community.
I'm going to blank on the name. Hang on a second, I'll tell you. Pat Hoover is
a local resident in Eugene. But she grew up in the Dalles, and she and her family have suffered enormously as downwinders. And so she, in between each poem, Kathleen would read a poem, one of her poems, and then Pat would talk about some of her experiences that related to some of the themes in each of the poems. And it was actually a very moving presentation. But I spent time recruiting people at that meeting to help with the effort that you and I have talked about before to get the Eugene Water and Electric Board to take a position for closing the Columbia Generating Station. Since everyone knows that Hanford's waste is a problem, most people don't realize that we have generated as many curies of radioactive material at the Columbia Generating Station as on the entire rest of the Hanford Nuclear Reservation.
Wow.
And that's because these commercial reactors are really extremely large. The production reactors for making plutonium that the U.S. Department of Energy built are smaller reactors. They then reprocess the waste that comes out of these reactors after they've been operating for a while and use this spent fuel to extract plutonium for our nuclear weapons. And created a witch's brew of liquid sludge that's in 177 underground storage tanks that we've had enormous difficulty figuring out how to stabilize, and then also a bunch of contaminated facilities. So the form that the waste is in is actually more problematic on the Hanford Reservation in terms of making nuclear weapons. At least you can say with the spent fuel at the Columbia Generating Station that it's contained in that spent fuel. However, that spent fuel is extremely dangerous. If you were exposed to just one fuel assembly after it had been out of the reactor for a year, you would die. You would get a lethal dose within seven seconds if it were not shielded. 10 years later, it would take only a little over a minute for you to get a lethal exposure if it were standing just to one fuel assembly. And 100 years later, it would take 12 and a half minutes for you to get a lethal dose if you were standing there.
100 years later.
100 years later. So it just gives you an idea of just exactly how hot and radioactive this stuff is. And another way of realizing just how hot it is that the Fukushima accident happened over 5 years ago. Over 6 years ago. And they still can't get robots close enough to the melted cores to figure out exactly where they're located. That's, you know, they keep sending more and more sophisticated robots, but
not only that, they're spending
the radioactivity is so high. So this Columbia Generating Station is a waste generating station of epic magnitude that's sitting at Hanford, that if they had an accident and released that material, would contaminate the area worse than Hanford ever has. You know, we could have potentially a Fukushima-style accident or worse there. So we are we got the city of Seattle to take a very mild position for closing it as soon as possible if we can replace it with carbon-free alternatives. And we're hoping to get a critical mass, if you will, of regional utilities that buy their power from Bonneville, who is the agency that markets the power from this reactor, to take a position for closing this plant down. And EWIP seems like a really good choice, good progressive community. We're starting to talk to you, talk to Juan, talk to other local activists about getting a campaign together to get EWIP to join Seattle in calling for the closure of the CGS.
Well, the next hearing, I just pulled up the local EWIB agenda. The next hearing that they're going to have is going to be July 11th at 5:30. There will be a public hearing. They allow 15 minutes, I guess, for public comments.
Okay. Yeah. So, well, maybe we can sort of gear up for that and start having our conversations with the commissioners. You know, now, right, before the hearing.
Well, this is about long-term planning. The whole agenda seems to be about long-term planning. Electric Water Board 10-year capital improvement plans, source protection 10-year plan, electric and water long-term financial plan, 2018 budget assumptions. This would be a good hearing to come in and bark a little bit about that we don't want their nuclear power.
Well, yeah. And the nice thing for us is that this, we've been able to demonstrate with our economist, Robert McCullough, that we could save money even if we replaced it 100% carbon-free by closing this plant, because as it ages, it's requiring more and more repair work, and it's the price of renewables just keeps going down. Mm-hmm. So its days are numbered, and hopefully we can end it sooner rather than later, because then we reduce the risk of a catastrophic accident, and we reduce the amount of this incredibly lethal toxic waste that's generated there that we leave to future generations to cope with.
I mean, this is the other thing. I think this, I don't know if it came out in the hearing, to be honest, my head is jumbled with all the stuff I've been reading, but I think they were talking about how in the hearing, these nuclear power facilities really just generate products that can be used for nuclear weapons. That's one of the issues that happens. And I think one of the arguments about that is we have enough material to build nuclear weapons. If that's what was the point of the secrecy and the allowing them to go ahead and do whatever they needed so that we could, you know, pretend that we need 20% of energy at billions of dollars a cost. I mean, if that's what they're doing, yeah. They have enough already. So we need to
That's not what they're doing in the United States anymore, though. I mean, it was definitely what the whole reason that it was started, obviously. But they built way beyond that. I mean, people in the industry making weapons saw an opportunity to start a new industry, and they were overly optimistic, as they've been all along. Papering over the problem areas and accentuating their positive spin. And this has been the pattern with nuclear power. And, it's an incredibly hard thing to do. One of the things I didn't have time to read into the record, because the chair only gave us 2 minutes each because there were so many people there to testify. But it's, there's an incredible quote, and listeners might want to go look this up on the web. Admiral Hyman Rickover, who was the father of the nuclear Navy and the early developer of nuclear reactors, has written, he wrote a paper in 1953 that he just circulated among his people that worked for him, and then later put it into the record when they were creating the Atomic Energy Commission in Congress. But it's called Paper Reactors Versus Real Reactors. And it's just really kind of devastatingly honest critique of how hard it is to make nuclear power work. You know, everything looks so much better on paper than it does when you're actually trying to build one.
Isn't that what John Goffman said, though? He's like, this is great technology, but we need to understand it more before we put it into wide scale. John Goffman was not anti-nuclear in any shape or form. He just asked them to slow the train down.
Initially, he was not, but he became,
that's true, but it took a really long time.
Right, as he learned more about the physical effects, I mean, he referred to it as random premeditated murder because it's now, he, by the time he finished his work in studying health effects of radioactive material when he was at Lawrence Livermore Laboratory, he realized that there was no minimum dose, that any amount that of radioactivity that a person's body is exposed to increases the chance that they'll get a cancer. And so therefore, even if you limit the amount of exposure that people get, you're still condemning some people to cancer just by operating these things, you know, however small number it is. If you make mistakes, then it's going to be a larger number. Or if you design it in ways that aren't as effective, it's going to be a larger number. This has always been an engineer's, you know, on paper dream. It's like, how can I take this really deadly material, which generates a lot of heat, and turn it into, you know, steam and generate a lot of electricity, and then also keep everyone safe at the same time? There's got to be a way to do it. And this Dr. Reyes from Oregon State is one of those kind of engineers who sees this technical challenge and has this boundless optimism about being able to overcome the challenge.
Well, you
and
know, it's
I just
funny
wish
you
they
mentioned
would,
that.
They'd get over that and take on lesser challenges, like how do you store right. Solar electricity overnight better, you know, or how do we make our grid work better? I mean, those are the kinds of technical challenges. I'm glad engineers are working on that. I just wish there were more of them working on that and none of them working on ways to take this extremely dangerous material and somehow make a positive out of it.
Well, you know, in 1954, I just looked this up, Admiral Hyman G. Rickover gave an address in 1954 to the U.S. Navy Postgraduate School. And one of his quotes that came out of it said that optimism and stupidity are nearly synonymous.
Love that.
So when you just mentioned
seriously?
That. Yes.
Can you forward that to me? That, yes. That basically says everything in his paper reactors versus real reactors in a single phrase, you know.
Uh-huh. I mean, it just popped up, but I was like, wow, because you were talking, this is one of the hallmarks of the nuclear industry is like unrelenting and really unfounded optimism. They're optimistic that no matter how much pollution they create, that we'll find a solution for it somehow, and that the death rate and the destruction of people's quality of life is worth the risk to discover this technology.
Mm-hmm.
That's their point of view. I mean, and I think this is where those of us who want to have an end to this industry, and I mean, I feel like I've come to this, after I went to that hearing the other night, I realized, you know what, this, when I first got into this, when I first became aware that this was such a catastrophic event, I was kind of angry. Like, How come we have to do this? Why are there activists doing this for 30, 40 years? And then when I came home, I realized, you know, plutonium on the drive home from Eugene to Salem, about an hour and a half, I was thinking about the whole meeting and how there were people in that meeting that were older, much older people who said they had been at hearings in 1980. And I thought, you know, when I first got into this, I was angry. And then I realized, you know, plutonium lasts for 24,500 years. So as long as it lasts, there's going to be nuclear promoters. So, you know, we're going to have to just kind of put on our courage feet and just decide, you know what, they're not going to go down easy. Perpetrators.
Yeah, we
got to
put on our lead aprons, you know. And,
you bet. And decide we're going to walk through it for a long time. This is the thing. I'm hoping that if millions of people get engaged in this, the more people put energy into this, we can, because we're going to have a nuclear industry because we have this waste. But what we need to do is shift their focus from producing more to, okay, what do we do with what we've created?
Well, one of the things that was encouraging about fighting back this SB 990 in the Oregon legislature was it did engage a lot more people. In a way, they did something that they probably wish they hadn't at this point, especially because the mainstream environmental groups joined up with us. You know, they've been trying to court them. They're desperate to try and put a green coating on nuclear because it has a lower carbon footprint, and can replace fossil fuels. Just the fact that we had that and a lot of the representatives for these other environmental groups are younger. They weren't around during all of these fights over nuclear power, so they're not really as familiar with the arguments, and now they're becoming more familiar, and they're beginning to realize why it was that people were against nuclear in the first place. So I thought that was a really positive aspect of having to do this fight right now.
I was actually kind of stunned that most of the people in that room were on the against side than the pro side. I was really, and one of the things that Kevin Finnegan pointed out, the only pro-nuclear people was a rancher who probably made a deal with NuScale to put the thing on his property, and their students at OSU, right? I mean,
yeah, and the NuScale employees.
Yes,
right.
The NuScale employees. And the interesting thing is the way they frame it. Like one of the young ladies said, well, I'm educated. I'm not afraid of the nuclear stuff. And what's interesting, that shows that what they're training these students is that this hysteria over the harm that it can cause is unfounded. That's what they're saying to the students. Like, don't worry about it. And yet we see articles all the time about this. You know what I'm saying? Hey, Chuck, somebody's calling in. Do you want to engage them?
Sure.
Okay, let's see if we can add them to the group call. I don't know if I can successfully do that, but let's see.
Okay.
Good morning. You're on the air with Lonnie Clark and Chuck Johnson from the Age of Fission radio show. Hello? So I didn't do it, Chuck. It didn't work. They're not answering. So they look like they're on, but we can't hear them. So I have no idea what this is. I don't hear
them. They can take mute off if they have mute on their phone. But anyway.
Okay. Well, that didn't work. Yeah. So this is the thing about these youth, the youth that's going on out there is the youth is really a lot of them are just not being informed of, and you know, ironically, because they're the ones that are most harmed. It's very shocking, you know, that I had a young woman who told me that in France, the French know how to deal with their waste. So it's kind of a shock.
That's what she said?
Yeah. She basically said that the people in France know how to manage their waste and that they have solutions for the waste. And I said, where'd you learn that? She's like, my professor told me that they have learned how to deal with their waste, that they're figuring it out. That's just the left is holding the nuclear industry back.
That's, such a load of stuff. You know, that's crazy. You know, the French have they have their own Hanford. It's called Le Havre, and it's a place where they've been reprocessing their spent nuclear fuel, and they have the same waste streams as Hanford. They are, you know, experiencing some of the same leaks and problems there. They have a long pipe that they pump radioactive material out into the ocean, and to with Ireland and Norway objecting to it because the currents, the ocean currents, take them along the Irish Sea, along the Scottish coast, actually, and then up to Norway. They do not have agreement yet on a permanent disposal site for their high-level waste. Have a site that they're talking about doing it in, that they have been, you know, exploring, but they don't have it solved. And the one thing that the French did do was standardize their first round of nuclear reactors and make them more competitive economically than most of the rest of the nuclear industry in the world. They were state-run.
So that they have identical nuclear reactors that are being built?
They were more successful at finishing reactors. Only half of the reactors that were started in the United States actually got finished. So it was an economic meltdown that occurred. And it wasn't due to the efforts of anti-nuclear activists. It was due to the incompetence of the nuclear power industry. It's one of the reasons why Wall Street is very leery of nuclear power. In France, it was state-run. So the state, federal government of France runs their electric grid and designed and built their reactors. The costs were...
Hey, I'm going to interrupt you. This gentleman's trying to reach us again, so I'm going to let him in. Hold on just a second. Let's see if we can successfully do this. Good morning. You're on the air with Lonnie Clark and Chuck Johnson. Hello? Nope. You know what I'll do is I'll make an attempt to call him. He's called us three times. Bring him in and we can't hear him. So I'm going to make an effort to do a little phone call and do a reverse call. Maybe that would be an easier way to bring him in. I have the phone number. Yeah, we have about 10 minutes. I'd love to hear what his question is because he's obviously been relentless. So let's see if we can bring him into the group call.
Let's do it.
The other thing I was going
to say about France is that their new reactor has been a total bust.
Hello?
Hey, you're on the air with Lonnie Clark. Who is this?
This is Tim Martin. Hi, Lonnie.
Tim. Hi, Tim. Thanks for joining us. Tim is an activist that I've met through the YouTube community, Chuck. So what's your question? You've been pretty good, relentless. I'm glad I was able to call you back.
I've never called into a talk show before. I just wanted to...
Thank you.
Yeah, I've never called into a talk show before. Well, I don't know if it's a question. I guess it's just a statement. Am I on air? Can I talk?
Yes, you're definitely on air.
Yeah. Well, I just want to point out that today on Google, on both the news channels, Governor Kate Brown and Governor Jerry Brown of California both applied for federal disaster assistance because of the catastrophic collapse of the fishing in Oregon and Washington.
Wow.
And they're just saying they use the word catastrophic. Unprecedented collapse, that not a word about Fukushima or what the cause is.
Or
Hanford, yes, on the Columbia. And there they are just asking for money. And nobody knows how much or who it's going to go to or whatever. And not a mention of the cause, you know, which is the Pacific Ocean dying. And nobody's following this.
I'm going to jump in on this one because I actually don't think that it was Fukushima that caused that.
I know you and I disagree on this. Yeah, I think that it's not Fukushima. What I think, Chuck, is that it's destroying the biota of the Pacific. That's what I think. And I think it does contribute. Well, I think there's been a concerted effort by the nuclear industry to have everybody disregard the effects of nuclear pollution on our atmosphere. So I think it's kind of a combination.
They definitely downplayed it. But I also think that the fact that you can find cesium in the tissue of tuna that swim across the ocean, that's definitely from Fukushima, indicates that it's getting into the biota, as you say. I don't think that's what caused this collapse, and was the heat wave that we had a couple of years ago that basically killed most of the smolt that was trying to get downriver to get out to the ocean. That's what caused this collapse of salmon. But, you know, you're right. Anything that adds to the toxic burden of marine life is bad, but I think it's relatively small. The Pacific Ocean is huge, huge. It can absorb an awful lot of toxics. They're not allowing fishing right off the coast of Fukushima for good reason, but and they probably shouldn't further than they are allowing. But all the way on the other side of the ocean here, the amount of radioactivity that we're getting is small. It's measurable, but it's small.
Chuck, I'm going to push back on this one because, first off, the salmon swim across the ocean into that. But we've had 6 years, now almost seven, nonstop over 300,000 tons of nuclear waste pouring into the Pacific. Nonstop. It's nonstop. So it is getting on top of Chernobyl, on top of, Sellafield.
Mm-hmm.
You know,
mm-hmm.
Sellafield puts 9 million liters of radioactive. I mean, it has to affect us. It's like mm-hmm. what's going on in Norway. Mm-hmm. We have been trained systematically to go, don't worry about it. It's too insignificant. But at this point, these nuclear disasters, and especially considering the salmon swim up and down the Columbia River, where we know Hanford mm-hmm. is, and the fact that they don't test the salmon really for nuclear, they just don't test them.
They have, you know, the tribal governments have been testing in the Fraser River and in the Columbia River for radionuclides, and they found some in salmon. It's not huge, but the fact that it's there at all, you know, it's
not a
good sign.
I guess I've jumped in late here, and I'm not familiar with the gentleman. Your name is Chuck?
Chuck Johnson,
yeah.
From Oregon Physician
Chuck Johnson.
For Social Responsibility. Yes.
So Oregon Physician for Social Responsibility? Well,
yeah.
Yes.
I can, I was, I can really kind of speak, even though I don't have a degree in biology or fisheries management. I've been a lifelong sport fisherman, and I'm very familiar with all the life cycles of all the fishing, of all the fish. And the drought years that are coming in, we haven't even got into that yet. The drought years was 2012, 2013, and 2013, 14, and 15. And these fish mm-hmm. that are coming in now or not coming in, this run is small, but they're on a 5-year life cycle. So the escapement that was out in the ocean was actually record. And we had record, mm-hmm. actually 10-year or 20-year records that are out in the ocean. And in return, we're getting these massive collapses. And it's because that the sardines have collapsed for 4 years and the herring have collapsed mm-hmm. for 4 or 5 years. There's no food in the ocean. And the fish that are coming in now, my friends that are catching the fish, they're coming in full 5-year spring Chinook. And they're coming in at 8-9 pounds. They should be 20 or 30 pounds.
Wow.
So it's a starvation event in the ocean. And the ODFW checks the scales. They can count the years on the scales just like you would the rings on a tree. They know these fish are 5 years. They spent 5 years in the ocean. And they're coming in at about 75% to 80% decline, and they're coming in almost a quarter of their normal weight.
Wow.
It's unprecedented. The fish have never been small, and it's because the anchovies have collapsed, the sardines have collapsed, and the herring have collapsed, all four of those bait fish. And those mm-hmm. bait fish also, those bait fish are on a 9-month to 2-year life cycle. So they've been in collapse for 5 years now.
So they're not coming back. Huh. Anchovies grow for 9 months, sardines and herring 2 years. So the whole thing has collapsed. They've had it. The ocean has been closed to fishing those bait fish for 4 years. There's no food in the ocean. So that's why the fish.
Well, you're making me want to. You make some really good points, and now I realize I need to dig into this more. So thank you for that.
I can get you in touch with Tim afterwards. You guys can talk. I'll send Tim your phone number. You guys can talk because Tim is actually a
Yeah. I know fish. Sounds like it. And
I know
what
you're
right.
It's my heart. Okay, go ahead. Sorry.
Right. I was repeating what I was told at, incorrectly, apparently, by somebody from Bonneville. So,
well, this is what
they
happens.
They are such liars. They are such liars. They are lying about the numbers. Kevin Blanche has been working on that. They are in total. They've said the fish cam has been down for 3 years. Mm-hmm. Can you imagine that for feet? So you could look at the fish. If I am fishing and I see a fish jump, I can tell you if it's a male or a female or what species it is just by a flash of seeing it jump. These fish they should be 15 to 30 pounds. They're coming in 8, 7, 10 pounds. And they've been in the ocean for 5 years. And they have sores on them, and the meat is white. It's not salmon colored, it's white. My friends in Portland,
so they're not eating
them on the Willamette. They're starving.
They're not eating the krill, probably, or whatever
it
is.
The krill's god, too. It's primarily the anchovies, herring, and sardines. And you can Google, just Google sardine collapse, herring collapse. All those bait fish have been in collapse. And the bad thing is they've been in collapse for 4 years, and they're on a 9-month to 18-month life cycle.
Well,
so
I guess the
broken.
Question then is, you know, if you're going to make a link with Fukushima, I mean, that you know, you now have established overall deterioration. The question is, what's caused it? I know they have this heat blob that's out there in the center of the Pacific.
You know what that heat blob is?
They're
going to
blame it on that.
No, you know what the heat blob is? The heat blob is the radioactive plume that they said would hit our shores. 6 years ago, there was a thing where they said, oh, we're going to have this massive radioactive, they called it a massive radioactive contamination that was floating across the ocean because it clings together. This was a story I read in 2012, and it said it would hit our shores between 12 and 16. Now that it's here, they call it a heat blob, and they are specifically not testing it for radioactive nuclides because I called and asked. No, they're not testing it.
And they have actually 4 months ago, they said they tested for the water, just the water itself tested for Fukushima radiation in Gold Beach, Oregon, and Tillamook Bay, which is the south to the north.
Right.
I think what's happened is it's the they don't even really know. I'm going to fall back on Kevin Blash. They don't even really know what's going on with what's coming off of Fukushima because it's such an unprecedented mix of different types of radiation and different products like steel and concrete or whatever. And it's collapsed the food chain. It's the smallest things that have collapsed.
Oh my gosh.
It's what the sardines and the herring, it's what the sardines and the herring eat. And you can just Google sardine collapse or herring collapse. It'll come up with all the numbers.
Wow.
And the bad thing
is
people
don't
realize.
Well, look, I need to jump in. We have 30 seconds left, Tim. So thanks
all right,
for joining
all right,
us.
Cool. Hey, thanks. Chuck. Hey, nice to meet you. You can call
that was
me if
an
you
interesting
want to.
We didn't know. Yeah, let's talk some more.
I'll put you guys in touch together. Chuck, thank you for joining us. Thank
you
for that unexpected phone call. Put your courage feet on. Oregon Physicians for Social Responsibility. Please go to their website and look for the actions that they're taking. Obviously, we get to share information and move towards closing down the nuclear industry. Talk to you guys.
Bye.